VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com. Code program.
This is the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today, what did Manchester United learn from their thrashing at the Etihad? Another hat-trick for Erling Haaland. We'll ask, are City impossible to beat? Arsenal beat their North London rival Spurs 3-1, but does Conte ball need to come to an end very, very soon? We'll react to the sacking of the Wolves manager Bruno Lage after just 16 months in charge. And we'll ask you about Liverpool. What needs to change if they're ever to return to being Premier League title contenders, as well as judging our most underrated players in the league today. This is The Game. Hello again, I'm Hugh Woozencroft. Welcome back to The Game Podcast. I'm alongside Tom Roddy, Gregor Robertson and Tom Clark today. Going to be a great conversation, I'm sure. And do you know what? My mood is good today. I'm a happy man. Honestly, I've had a great weekend. I went to the NFL in London. Do you know what that means? It means I didn't watch the Manchester Derby live. So ignorance is bliss. You know, 6-3. Respectable scoreline in many ways for Manchester United this weekend as Manchester City romped home in that Manchester Derby.
Look. Did you look at your phone though just to kind of end it up being depressed?
Do you know what was going on? So a lot of people in, and John Jackson, our producer, was there with me as well. Ooh, a lot of people who were there had gone back into the, yes, hospitality box, I'll say it.
Way!
Yeah, prawn sandwich brigade. To watch the game. And I stayed. And I kept an eye on the New Orleans Saints and the Minnesota Vikings because I knew what was going to happen. Manchester United were going to be brought crashing back down to earth. It was inevitable. Even in the 4-win run, there were a couple of, you know, pretty scraped 1-0 victories. So, look, I think we know Manchester United are a golf away. And this just underlined it. Erling Haaland, third hat-trick of the Premier League season, made all the less impressive by the fact Phil Foden got one as well. But it was the kind of afternoon that did remind us, didn't it, that so many people think the Premier League is a foregone conclusion, and this is why. You know, City are unbelievable. Manchester United, a long way from being a top side. We'll start with City. Simple question. Gregor, I'm going to start with you. Are they going to be impossible to beat this season?
They look ominous. The first half was some of the best football you can remember seeing, really, in the Premier League. So many threats, so much kind of intensity about the play as well. It's not just like how good they are with the ball, it's their speed, the kind of how direct they are. And now what Haaland has done is changed the kind of the nature of how direct they are as well. It's like they, when they break, if they can get the ball to Kevin De Bruyne, it's like it's almost a foregone conclusion. James Gearbarton wrote about this today, and it was like, everyone knew when he got the ball in the pocket of space. Mm. Even Manchester United defence knew what to do, but there was really no stopping it because his reach and his kind of athleticism is just remarkable. And De Bruyne is one of the best passers of the ball that the Premier League's seen. So those two were just incredible. And Manchester United were miles off. It was like, they were so sloppy in the opening exchanges that, like, you know, they were going to be in for a tough afternoon as it was, but they kind of invited City onto them as well, which was just, it was just remarkable to watch.
There were a few performances in my opinion, like Manchester United's this weekend. You could underline the number of sort of half-hearted presses from certain players in the Premier League this weekend, the lackluster tracking back. You know, it wasn't every team. Some teams were on it, some teams weren't. I don't know if the international break affected the Manchester United players much, but they weren't at it for a derby match away from home. It just wasn't good enough. And I think if you're not good enough against Manchester City, they're going to batter you. They're that good, right? So was it just those two things coming to pass, Tom?
I think it was a little bit of that, yes. I mean, to me, the other ominous thing is the subject of Paul Hurst's piece of analysis this morning, which talks about the City's defence as well. And obviously, we can talk forever about Foden and Haaland and De Bruyne and Grealish as well. I thought Grealish was very good and looks to be improving all the time, playing off Haaland and coming into little pockets of space. But I mean, the fact that you've got Akanji, who is probably, you know, if Haaland's the best signing of the summer, he's got to be up there in top five in terms of very clever purchases. He looked completely at ease, you know, kind of definitely ticked the Rolls-Royce type box in terms of defence. And the fact that I was talking about it with Paul Hurst before the game, we were speculating, does this give United a chance? Akanji, Ake, they've had to change the defence again. You know, we think about it in terms of conversations that we've had around the Premier League teams, and we talk about, oh, they can't get a settled defence. City seem to be fine without a settled defence. Someone's like, they want a settled defence. It changes all the time. Walker came off, Gomez comes on, Cancelo switches it to the right. Like, it's so impressive the way it doesn't seem to affect them at all. So, I mean, that to me was the most ominous thing, because if you're thinking about, that's the big question, and we're sat in the office this morning as editors discussing it, oh, do we try and do a piece on how do you stop Haaland? Don't worry, Gregor, I got you out of it. But you try and think, okay, well, maybe teams can get at them then, but, you know, they just can't. And I mean, I know United scored 3 goals, but as you say, Hugh, they were coming off the back of 4 good performances. But even players like Antony, Sancho's had a brighter start to the season, Rashford's won player of the month, like, they just couldn't get any change out of Akanji and Ake. And I just thought that was as ominous and brilliant as the forwards are, that was a really telling thing in terms of City and what they can do this season.
I mean, you've got to say, on top of that though, some of it was like simple miscontrols or like just really sloppy wayward passes.
Yeah, they were very sloppy.
Malassi as well, a little inside pass straight to De Bruyne, and Dalot was like, looked like a nervous wreck against Grealish at the start. So there's a lot of people, there's a lot of kind of reversion to the mean.
You've got to say as well,
it wasn't just kind of,
we've given Eriksen a lot of praise. I think that was his worst game.
Yeah.
He was dreadful in the first half, I think. He'd been brilliant, but it looked so, we'd made a lot of it beforehand. James Gearbrand had written his football newsletter last week about Eriksen playing in this deeper role. It almost felt like that was United's one real bright spark this season. And you're kind of going, okay, well, you think City aren't going to spot that? Of course they did. There were so many intercepted passes of Eriksen's, weren't there, where he was kind of looking up in that deep quarterback role that we call it, trying to spray passes, and they were just all being intercepted because it's like, yep, we know what you're going to do, mate.
I understand the logic in starting Eriksen and McTominay after the performance they've had so far this season, and Ten Hag spoke about that, the positivity, and you can't change a winning formula in a way. But at the same time, you look at the way the teams that play well against City, and it tends to be teams like Palace or Tottenham, and the approach is always that kind of a strong, solid defence and midfield, with a midfield that will sit in front of the defence, and then players like Son, Richarlison, Kane, and then Eze, Odson-Edouard and Zaha, who just hit you on the counter-attack. They tend to be the most effective against City because they may be lulling them in a little bit. And it certainly isn't easy, but you feel like United had that a little bit. They have those players to be able to potentially do that because of having Sancho, Rashford, Antony. I feel like they had the players to do that. And it's easy sitting here on Monday morning in hindsight, but I'm still quite surprised Casemiro didn't start that game. It seems, that seems illogical to me.
We don't really know why he's not been starting much since his arrival from Real Madrid, to be perfectly honest. Maybe we've got an answer to why Cristiano Ronaldo's not playing at all. I mean, that is a big one. We saw some rants from some big names this weekend about him not being at the club to sit on the bench. You know, what was the word that Ten Hag used? You know, saving his...
Disrespecting his career, wasn't
it? Yeah, disrespecting his career. You know, left him on the bench for those reasons. I mean, it's a derby match. It's Cristiano Ronaldo. I mean, why wouldn't he play, Gregor?
Oh, clearly he meant when, you know, you're 4-0 down at half-time, whatever. So, I don't...
Is it disrespecting his career to leave him on the bench in the first place?
No.
Not with what Tom said about, you know, teams that do well
exactly,
getting at City and how United have played. Rashford, Player of the Month, as we said. I actually didn't mind it. And I mean, as much as Roy Keane can say he thinks it's a disgrace to leave him on the bench and things, I kind of saw what Ten Hag meant. Like, in that scenario, when I was watching the game, I think, you're not going to gain anything from bringing Ronaldo on here.
No.
And his argument with Martial was that, okay, we bring Martial on because he needs some minutes and that he'd been part of pre-season and then he got injured. And he comes on and gets some minutes and some goals. So I don't buy the whole furore around Ronaldo in this specific instant.
And on like a basic human level, I kind of have some sympathy about the fact he wanted to leave and they kind of said no, just because it's, you know, he's getting towards the end of his career and he'll want to play. Who knows who was going to take him? Like, you know, there was like rumblings about clubs like Napoli or something. I don't know if he's going to, if he's really going to be up for that. So we don't know all the kind of machinations behind the scenes about that, but if he really wanted to leave and there was an option there and they said no and they're not going to use him, you know, that seems like it's not really benefiting anyone.
What do we learn about Erik ten Hag's Manchester United during this game? Did we learn much, Tom?
I think if I was them, I would almost just try and banish any thoughts of this whatsoever immediately, because in the grand scheme of things, the performances they've had against Arsenal and against Liverpool have been extremely positive. And I think we have seen progress in these early weeks, and we've got to remember how early this is in Ten Hag's tenure. So like you said, Hugh, at the beginning, this result wasn't a surprise, and it shouldn't have been a surprise. And when you've got the best attacking midfielder or the best midfielder in the world playing with the best striker in the world, it really shouldn't be a surprise when these things happen. I think that the takeaway they may have is being a little bit more pragmatic when approaching these games, because in hindsight, it looked naive.
And I think they were pragmatic. I just think they were really, really poor.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
they were so sloppy. I can't kind of emphasize that enough. And I think what we learned was that, you know, although we've seen promise from Malacia, Dallow's been improved this season. They're not really
elite.
You know, well, even if they're not elite, I think you can say that about Dallow. Malacia's new to the Premier League. This is a big game. He looked nervous. He looked like he didn't look the same player we've seen.
That was what Ten Hag said, wasn't it? The confidence.
Yeah.
He said that was part of his mistake as well. He didn't get any confidence out of the players.
Yeah. And while Anthony scored a screamer, you know, he's new to the Premier League. Sancho still kind of doesn't seem to quite have the sort of mentality to think, I'm going to go and stamp my authority in this game. Not in the same way as Foden did or Grealish did or, you know, most of Manchester City's attacking players. So there's like still a kind of reminder that they're not at the same level in that kind of winning competitive spirit level, actually. And they've got some players who are probably not up to the level as players either.
I'm still not convinced they use Sancho in the right way, though, as well, at United. I don't think they use him in the same way Dortmund did. And when you look at what happened with Bukayo Saka and Phil Foden on international duty with England, and the way that the two clubs have used them in this weekend, they're totally different players because they're being played and deployed in the right way.
Okay, all right. Manchester United battered by Manchester City. Not a new headline, unfortunately, for Manchester United fans. They get to bounce back very quickly in Cyprus against Omonia in the Europa League on Thursday. So that's the way you forget about a defeat, a big defeat to Manchester City, by bouncing back in the Europa League and against Everton next weekend in the Premier League as well. Elsewhere this weekend, Arsenal beat their North London rival Spurs 3-1. They make it 7 wins on the bounce at home in the Premier League. Mikel Arteta's side staying top of the table. Comfortable for lots of the game. They're also helped by a red card for the Spurs defender Emerson Royale. But I think we have to discuss, at least start by discussing, some of the dismay of the Spurs fans. Because despite their positive start in terms of results, sitting back, playing on the counter in this way, Conte ball that many people have dubbed it, it may work at times. Does it work for Spurs? Because even though they've got results, as I've said before, I think we should have seen an improving Tottenham, one that took a big step forwards. They haven't really from last season. To some, they've taken a step backwards. Players sitting in deep, but they were quite passive as well. And I think that played a part in the result in the North London derby. Tom Roddy, I'll start with you. Is Conte ball a thing of the past? If not, does he need to change it for this Spurs squad?
I don't think it's a thing of the past. I think it's that formation and approach which tends to be very effective, but also can be nullified. The thing that I think they miss, Spurs, is the guy in the middle of the park who creates. When Conte won the Premier League at Chelsea, he had Cesc Fabregas playing that role, the creator in chief. At Inter Milan, he had Christian Eriksen playing that role. It's the De Bruyne, essentially, the guy who threads it all together. And actually is quite possibly the most important player in the Conte team, even though there's that focus on the wingbacks. I remember Conte's first game for Spurs was at Everton, and he was desperately trying to get Højbjerg to do that. And Højbjerg is not that player. And what we've seen is Dier taking on that role a little bit as the quarterback, but he can't roam as much as you would like to. It needs to be a centre mid. It needs to be someone who has the license to get forward a bit more. And also, you know, for however good Dier is as a centre back and as a ball playing centre back, he doesn't compare to Eriksen and Fabregas in terms of creativity. So I think they really suffer without a player like that.
Should they have put a third midfielder in there? I think a lot of the Spurs fans were saying, look, you know what Arsenal are going to have in midfield. They've played well this season with three in there. We shouldn't be playing 3-4-3 in this game. I know they point to the second half against Leicester City when they scored all those goals and they had an extra player in midfield. Should they have done it? I'll ask you, Gregor, was it the right team selection this weekend from Conte?
I don't know. When Conte has this system working at its best, that three-man defence with two sitting on front of it is pretty hard to break down. And what you said at the start, they start too deep. They didn't step out to close down particularly Partey's strike, which is a lovely strike, but there was no pressure on the ball. Personally, I don't think we should be surprised by the way Tottenham are playing, first of all. I don't think there's a problem with the system. I think it's the way that they went out and performed it. That was what mattered. And also, they had openings. It was, you know, number of times Son's final ball was kind of sloppy or overhit. They had opportunities. It kind of worked to a certain extent, and then they had the sending off, which clearly kind of wrecked their chances of the game. But first, I go back to you can't be surprised. If Tottenham fans are surprised of the way that Conte is setting the team out, then they haven't been watching closely enough.
Kulusevski's a huge miss, isn't he? Like, in that team and the way he plays in that. He provides that creativity that Tom was quite rightly talking about. But then Conte's obviously signed Richarlison. I think he would arguably want to have Kulusevski's creativity and those front three, because, as Gregor said, they did cause Arsenal problems on the counter-attack. But the problem then came, back to Tom's point, was that you only had those three going forward. There were a couple of times in that first half where they would break, and then you would be looking for that second wave, looking for that out ball. And I think there was a couple, you know, Emerson Royale finally gets on the overlap. And I think even for the move that created the penalty, it was just the three of them forward. It was just those three. And there was no kind of cavalry arriving on the edge of the box that Tom was talking about. Like for Chelsea under Conte, Fabregas would always arrive in that little position to keep the pressure on, to keep the other opposition pinned back. And there just wasn't that for Tottenham. You know, Højbjerg's not that player. Bentancur, probably not that player. Like, they're missing that in midfield. So that's the difficulty. I agree with Gregor. I'm not that surprised about it, but Kulusevski's a big miss, and how he gets him in, whether he can get him in and the three forwards, I don't think he can. So I'd say that's a big problem for Tottenham, in that he was missing from this game. But I agree with Gregor. I don't think Conte's going to change all that much, to be honest. It's about in these big games how they get more out of that attack.
It's true. I think that a lot of fans think that when that's the front three, they're, as Tom's saying, they look more detached, whereas Kulusevski seems to link the kind of midfield and forward line better. And he's a bit more of a kind of, he can hold on to the ball as well to buy some time and let players support, whereas Son and Richarlison are all about direct lines and not really, they're the players who want to be running onto the balls, the through balls. They don't want to be doing, you know, Son was dropping deep and trying to slip balls in, and it didn't work. So Kulusevski's a big player for them now.
That game didn't play out any different to how we probably all expected it to, which was what made it quite fascinating, because Arsenal, possession-based team, attractive football, Tottenham, counter-attacking. And I thought you made a really important point, Gregor, that exactly what I thought. There were so many openings that Tottenham, I think Conte probably walked away from that game and thought, we should have won that, definitely, because there were so many openings, and they are the type of team that get ahead and then shut up shop, to use that horrible cliche. So it was exactly what we expected in terms of the way it played out, and I think they'll regret it, really. They'll rue it.
Can they continue this way during the season? If they do, where will Tottenham be? What do you think, Tom?
Can they continue playing this way? Yeah, and I don't think they should be downhearted about it. I think they're a top four team right now, and they'll have to aspire to more than that. I wonder whether January does become that point where they try and bring in that kind of player, the creative player, as well as missing Kulusevski. But also, they don't have to rush into anything at all in January, because they do have the players. The bizarre thing, in a way, is Bissouma. I've been a little bit surprised at how he hasn't been tried in that role a little bit. He's been had a bit part role, hasn't he, so far?
And now that Royal's kind of had a moment of madness, I think that gives an opportunity to someone else, which I think a lot of people will be rather relieved of.
Relishing the opportunity for Jed Spence, who we know Antonio Conte sort of alluded to wasn't a player that he wanted, so we'll see exactly who he does select in that role. Should mention a positive for Arsenal, shouldn't we, Tom?
Yeah, Super Mikel at it again. I backed him on Thursday and he delivered. Calm, composed, confident, commanding win, which, let's be honest, you know, it was what we discussed in the preview show, talking about those big moments at the Emirates, big games where they've kind of not bottled it, but almost gone too full throttle and lost their composure completely. They didn't do that. Hugh, you predicted a red card. It went to Tottenham, not Arsenal. I think, you know, you have to give them credit for that. They look really, really composed. And when you think about attacks, you know, we're just criticising Tottenham. Again, you have to give Arteta credit. You have those two banks of five that essentially they have, pinning the opposition back, completely smothering them. And that's where you then get a goal like the first one, where your right back, Ben White, plays it to your defensive midfielder to curl one in because the front five are already occupied. But then in the second half, he went even further than that and started saying to Ben White, get forward, get on the overlap. So you're then creating essentially like a front six, sometimes a front seven. He's going for it. He's identifying it. He's being bold in these big games and it's paying off. I think he deserves huge credit. And I mean, look, I'm sure there are some very positive Arsenal fans that would have liked us to chip in during our conversation with Man City and go, hey, we're still top, guys.
Yeah, I don't think they'll be top at the end of the season.
I don't think they will either.
That's the question.
But we do have to mention it, don't we? When you think about this game, yes, they lost to Manchester United, but arguably shouldn't. This is a hugely, hugely significant result for Arsenal and Arteta, I think. Like, massive, massive performance. The nature of it, more than anything, not just the fact they won, it's the nature of it, is the fact they completely dominated. They looked like the better team. They took their chances. They kept their composure.
Because you asked in the preview show, you know, who's this more important for? And most of us said Arsenal, really, because it's like, if not to say that they're going to be title challengers, to say that they can go deep into the season being in that kind of mix. And all the evidence suggests that they can. They're playing so much higher up the pitch, and that's result of having far more confidence in the guys at the back, because Saliba's in and he's formed a good partnership with Gabriel. Ben White's kind of exceeded most people's expectations at right back. Partey being fit is so important for them. And Xhaka's kind of looking like a new player and playing higher up the pitch. And you can go through so many positives. Martinelli, him staying fit as well, It's crucial. And Jesus, again, you've got to say just like the menace and the sort of
tenacity.
Tenacity, all those words that he provides. Is just priceless.
They just don't score. I know it's a mistake from Hugo Lloris, but they just don't score that goal if it's Nketiah. You know, if it was, he's just, you know, he's gone past two defenders to just throw his body in there to try and make something happen. He's ended up with a tap in, and it's just because of his sheer desire, to be perfectly honest. There's nothing against Eddie Nketiah as a footballer, by the way. I'm just saying there is something extra when it comes to good time to bring back Jesus versus Richarlison.
Hey, look, yeah, it might be.
You sure?
I'm still
maybe.
Backing him, all right?
Wilby had a good weekend as well, didn't he? Yeah, a little assist.
Yeah. Honestly.
Peace from Paul Rowan in the game today as well, just praising him, singing.
Hey, look, who was editing the game, Greg, yesterday? That's all I'm going to say. Look, but just on the desire thing, Hugh, I think as well, we're talking about them playing high up the pitch. You then have that, you know, they smother in attack and then they swarm in defence, don't they? Like, the drive to win the ball back as well. You know, you're finally seeing that in a very targeted and tactical way, not just the kind of headless chicken way. It all looks like it's working for Mikel Arteta at the minute.
I think it's also Arsenal deserves so much credit. And we'll say this time and time again, because there was that moment, wasn't there, around Christmas when we thought Arteta might go. And now the temptation must have been there. And we've seen again Bruno Lage going from Wolves, and it feels like the time span that managers get and the opportunities they get is shorter and shorter. The patience is running out so much quicker. But the effort that they've given to Arteta and the time they've allowed him to form something, and you've seen it develop, haven't you? You've seen the project move and develop, and it'll be attractive to people. It'll be attractive to players when it comes to transfer windows, thinking, where is that club going? Because Tottenham, can we guarantee that Conte will be there this time next year? Absolutely not. What are Chelsea going to be like? Who knows? It's a really uncertain period. Even with Liverpool, what's happening there at the moment, they are a very impressive project. But what I'm saying is there is progression at Arsenal, and it's attractive to a lot of players.
I was just going to say, like, I don't want to make too big a deal of this, but do you not think that the documentary as well is like, I think it's the first documentary that's actually had a positive impact on the perception of the manager and the club as a whole, actually, because the rest of them have been like PR exercises. They didn't shirk some big stories, and you saw Arteta, like, some cringeworthy moments, but he wears his heart on his sleeve. You see his passion, you see how much he wants the players to follow him, and actually you see a buy-in, and you see even Edu seems like a good guy, like a positive force behind the scenes. And you got to know Xhaka a little bit more. It's like, I actually feel that it's had a positive impact. It certainly must among the fan base. I'm not an Arsenal fan, and I look at the club slightly differently now. Why are you shaking your head at that?
Sorry, I didn't realise.
I don't want to make too big a deal about it, but I think it's had a positive effect, just changing the perception, the atmosphere in the club, because it was toxic.
Absolutely. They're playing great football at the moment, Arsenal. It's a North London derby win. I've got to say, I watched them and thought that they're playing the kind of football that would get them to the last eight of the Champions League. Like, they are playing such good football at the moment. Obviously, they're not in that top competition at the moment, but who knows what they could do in European football in terms of lifting the Europa League this season. And of course, that's to come on Thursday. Listen, much more to come. You mentioned Bruno Lage there, Tom. We're going to be talking about him next on the Game Podcast.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey.
They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
So we have another managerial sacking in the Premier League. Wolves parting company with Bruno Lage after 16 months in charge. That came after their defeat by West Ham this weekend. It leaves them in the bottom three in the Premier League table. He, of course, succeeded Nuno Espirito Santo last summer. Came 10th in his first season in charge, but they have won one and lost nine of their past 15 Premier League matches. It's been a pretty bad run. That's what the club alluded to when they dismissed him. Charlotte Dunker from the Times joins us on the game. Charlotte, was this a fair decision? Was it coming for some time?
Yeah, I think so. I think coming for some time is exactly the right way to describe it. If you look at the way Wolves finished last season and then the money that was spent over the summer, they spent over 100 million strengthening the squad, and then the way they've started this season, there's not really been any improvement. They've scored 3 goals in their opening 8 games. And like you say, if you go back of the stretch over to last season, they've had 1 win in the league in the last 15 games. And for a team that wants to be pushing and competing in Europe, that's really just not good enough.
Where does it leave the club now then?
So at the weekend, they play Chelsea, and they've got Steve Davis, who's the under-18s coach, and James Collins, who coaches the under-21 side. They're taking training this week. As I understand it, they're now obviously searching for a new manager. I don't think they sacked him and had a ready-made replacement in mind, because, as you know, there's not been an appointment in the last 24 hours since they made that decision to sack him. There'll be a short list of candidates drawn up, and then the owners will decide who the best fit is and then try and get them in as soon as possible. But whether that is before the Chelsea game or not, we don't know at the moment.
Will we see another Portuguese manager then come in?
Well, I think that's what everyone's expecting. I think, if you look at the team that they've got there, it's very heavy Portugal-based, isn't it? And they've got a very strong link with Jorge Mendes's agency. So a lot of people are suggesting that it will be one of his clients that would possibly come in. The name I've heard at the minute is the sporting manager, Ruben Amorim, is someone that they're interested in. He's a Portuguese manager, but he's not one of Mendes' clients. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see which move what move they take, where they go from here. But they need, I think it's, the Wolves have got a good squad. They've got a strong squad. They've got some very good players. So at the minute, the way they're performing and the results they're getting, they are underachieving. So they need a manager to be able to push them back up the table.
Okay, thank you, Charlotte Dunker from the Times, for joining us with that update on Wolves. Where then does it leave the club for you, Tom Clark?
I mean, a really interesting crossroads, I think, because I found it interesting listening to Charlotte there talk about the kind of Portugal connection, the managers that she's heard linked with the job. To me, it just feels like they need a complete refresh, because it feels like it's gone stale. I think that was the problem that Bruno Lage had. It all felt like much of the same. You know, I was discussing this with Tony Cascarino yesterday, and he felt that in that defeat against West Ham, an unfit and out of form Diego Costa for 20 minutes or however long he played was their best player. You know, Charlotte was saying it there. They've got a good squad. They've got talented, pretty top-level European players. But it just feels like the kind of Nuno era, then into Lage, it just felt all the same. And tactically as well, like, it all looks pretty similar. Like, they dominate possession. They don't create chances. Yes, they've changed the defence from a back three to a back four. That's interesting in that they got rid of some big players and some experience, particularly in Connor Cody. But I feel like they need a kind of shake-up. They need a manager who's maybe a bit more high-intensity in his demeanour as much as anything. You know, Bruno Lage is such a suave, kind of cool kind of character. You didn't really ever see him giving it the kind of Artetas or any of that on the touchline. So I wonder whether they need a little bit more of intensity and personality, and that'll then translate onto the pitch as well. But I think tactically as well, if you're going to sign Diego Costa, surely you need to maybe make your tactics, let's get the ball in the box and get the ball, well, maybe not over the top because he's not quite as young and as fit as he was when he was at Chelsea. I think they need to make a bold move, basically.
I don't think you necessarily need it on the sideline. Think of managers like Carlo Ancelotti, who just so... he's not a chest thumper, is he? But actually, Tom mentioned Connor Cody, and I think the loss of him is huge, because a lot of, when you look back to the Euros and England in the Euros, a lot of players speak about Conor Cody's influence, not on the pitch at all, but off the pitch, and having that presence and a guy who's been around the club and been part of the its progression and building and developing and bringing in reassurance, really, at a moment like this. I think they lost that, and we've seen it at other clubs where key players who bring a bit of levity, really, to the situation go, and that team unity is lost. But I think this probably comes in, like it does quite often, it comes into last season, and really they should have got the Europa League spot. The form that they lost falling off last season, they were on course to get that, and the progression that they were showing has just fell off, really. And again, Larg doesn't get the time, but you can sort of see why. And I thought his post-match press conference was telling that he knew this was coming, because he put his explanation out there: we haven't lost a game where a striker's been playing.
I feel some sympathy in that with him in that regard. I mean, he has been quite spiky. He can be quite spiky. He looks for excuses too often, in my opinion. But that is one valid one. You know, Jimenez has been out for a long period. They've not really had a kind of out-and-out striker. Costa, yeah, came on and looked... That was a kind of desperate signing, really. Mm. But he did come on and look dangerous. But they've kind of been... That's been a gaping hole in their team. They scored 41 goals in his 46 games. That says a lot. He's been odd. He did an okay job. He started really kind of lots of draws, I could seem to remember.
Yeah.
And then February, March, you were thinking they were flirting with the top four.
Often losing games they dominated as well.
Yeah. And a lot of kind of narrow wins, clearly, when you only scored 41 goals in 46 games. So, you know, part of me thinks if they'd had a kind of better striker, or Jimenez was fit, we wouldn't be having this conversation. I also have to say, I was slightly surprised he got the job in the first place. It was an odd appointment. It was like, and he seems to have done all right over the piece. But you know, he was a number two for a long time. He was at Sheffield Wednesday, I think, and was he at Swansea too? Because he was under Carvalho, I believe. So like, not really much experience as a number one. And I think, you know, the noises coming out too were that he's a good coach, but perhaps man management became an issue. And I think probably it's not just the results, it's that he seems to have kind of maybe lost the support of the dressing room a little bit as well.
I think the guys make points there that you can kind of combine into one factor. They need a new identity, I think. Yeah. You know, under Nuno, they were hard to beat, as you said. You know, they had players like Cody and Jimenez who were the players that you could think of, but they're almost heading into a bit of a, like, to me, like elite Watford level, where you have that thing where you can't name that many Wolves players. Like, I reckon if you ask the average Premier League football fan, go on, name me five Wolves players, I reckon they'd struggle, because they make these signings like Guedes and all these kind of players from Europe who come in and out. Fabio Silva was another one. Like, I reckon people would go Neves, that Moutinho lad, the keeper's quite good, but you know what I mean, like, because they're not grabbing.
Kilman played futsal, didn't he?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But they need that new identity now. You know, they've lost leaders on and off the pitch like Cody, big name players. They need a manager who's going to put a stamp on them in terms of identity tactically, and they need a manager who's going to bring some of these players through. Like, they've made these signings, like Guedes was hotly tipped around Europe for a long time. They need a manager who's going to bring some of these players through as well.
I think that's a good point, because, you know, a lot of this was, there's always been absolute support for Wolves owners, and despite the kind of links with Jorge Mendes' agency, because it was all very new, and Nuno did have that kind of, although he didn't have, you can't say he's a person who had like great sweeping personality, he had a clear identity and he gave that to the team. And as I say, it was all new, and they were on the rise. Since then, it is kind of, they've lost that, the early excitement of it. They've lost, as Tom says, some players who were kind of very easily identifiable with that rise. And what next is quite important. What happens next is important, because they are at risk of becoming a team that kind of, I don't know, they have that link with Mendes is remarkable, and they're signing half his stable, and it's like Portugal in the Black Country. It's That's it.
Yeah.
That's it at the moment. That's what Wolves are.
Ruben Amorim does have, I think, a lot of people who think he could be a very, very good coach. So, you know, just to hear that, if I'm a Wolves fan, I'd be pretty excited because it's an attacking brand of football. I think that's where their strength currently lies. You know, they don't concede many, they don't score many. But I think if you look at the squad, I think there are some explosive players they just need to get more out of, including the likes of Gadesh, but also, you know, Pedro Neto, who's so many been linked with big moves away. Adama Traore always on the bench, but physically we know what he can bring in terms of his explosiveness. It's just whether you can harness that in the right way. So it'll be interesting to see what happens next for Wolves. Sad for Bruno Lage, of course, commiserations with him, but the club moves on and they need to move on very, very quickly. And so the club moves on and we move on next to a big game at Anfield this weekend. We'll end with this one. We've got some more to come, but I mean, in terms of the results, the question really has to be how you fix Liverpool right now, because they were held to a 3-3 draw by Brighton at Anfield thanks to a Leandro Trossard hat-trick for the Seagulls. That's the first from one of their players in Premier League history. Liverpool have conceded first in 9 of their last 11 Premier League matches, and if they lose to Arsenal next weekend, they will be 14 points off the leaders. And really, you start thinking about whether this is the end of the incredible Klopp era. Because it was always going to be hard for Liverpool to keep up with the likes of Manchester City, even the likes of Manchester United and Chelsea, when it comes to their spending. Klopp has, I say, worked miracles. He's had a bit of money to spend, but from where he took Liverpool over and where he's brought them, absolutely incredible. Are they just going to be, and this is a bad period in terms of form, but are we looking at Liverpool being more of a top four side over the next few seasons than we are a title winning side, or at least a title contender? Is that too harsh of me? Have I gone a bit too early, gentlemen? Let me know what you think.
I think you're off the back of a Manchester derby thrashing there and you're trying to find some salvation. I know, I'll dig Liverpool out. That'll make me feel better. Perhaps a little harsh, yeah. But I do think there's an element where, as you say, Hugh, that Klopp era, it's not, you know, not on him, but on the team, on the pitch, it feels like it's a little bit stale and in need of a bit of a kind of more of a hard refresh, rather than these kind of players that you're being brought in. Your Thiago's incredibly talented, looks more and more at home when he plays, when he's fit, but it feels like you need a bigger change at the minute, because ultimately they look best when they go back to Firmino and Salah out wide with either Diaz or Jota. Ultimately, you know, they improved when Diaz came on at the weekend. But I mean, Salah's a fascinating one. He's kind of slightly emblematic of that point. I was looking, since he joined, he's played the most Premier League games of any outfield player. 187 games since he joined Liverpool in 2017. You know, more than the likes of your Tarkovskis, your James Ward-Prowses, your kind of players that you think, oh, they're the kind of players that play every minute. Salah's out in front. And I think that he himself just got this new contract. It's like, well, what does that mean for Liverpool going forward? Are they going to create a different system, different way of playing with Salah? Like, is he going to have a different role? It feels like they need a bit of a bigger refresh, and they're going through this period at the minute where they've signed Nunez. The sending off against Palace seems to have completely derailed him in terms of confidence. It feels tricky. I don't know whether saying they're going to be top four for the next few seasons is a bit punchy, but for this season, whether this season could be a refresh season and then they could come back again next season.
How good is Sadio Mane, hey?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, quite.
He gets better and better each week after he's gone. But I mean, that was said in jest, but quite possibly, because one thing that you notice watching Liverpool at the moment, and Gregor, you just said about Nuno Espirito Santo, you knew he had a model of how he played and his team reflected that. Klopp's is the same, isn't it? You know how Liverpool are going to play the heavy metal rock and roll football. And but part of that is the gegenpressing. And I do think Mane was a huge part of that, leading it. And that starts from the front. And I don't think they haven't got that this year so far, really. They've lost the pressing to an extent, the intensity. And what I thought was quite curious is the fact that Klopp often, throughout his whole time as manager at Liverpool, would make big name signings and he would bring them in, and we'd all sit here on podcasts like this and go, God, this is going to be great, and he's going to be doing this and he's going to be doing that. And then we end up watching him sat on the bench and getting a few minutes here and there, coming in. Nunez hasn't been that. He got thrown in. And as Tom said, that moment at Palace has totally shaken that guy. And you get anomalies like Luis Diaz, who just hit the ground running. But Nunez hasn't. And it just feels like at the moment a team of individuals than a group.
What's the stat? They've conceded first in all their games, in 9 games in a row?
9 in 11.
Right. And how many goals have they conceded? They've already conceded like nearly as many as all of last season at home. It's like, that's their starting point. There's two things. It's interesting to see Van Dijk actually speaking in the piece in the game today. He kept saying, he said it twice, that we need to defend from the front. And we also probably all saw Klopp's rant at kind of defending Trent Alexander-Arnold about the fact that we press from the front, we defend from the front. Of course, that'll leave space. But you can't say for any of those three goals it had anything to do with them pressing badly from the front. Trent Alexander, rubbish header, spin by Trossard, goal. The
second one was awful. Like, there's three players there, Henderson.
Yeah, no one made the challenge.
Matip doesn't come out quick enough.
Far too easy to score in their own, deep in their box.
Yeah.
And the third one, Van Dijk miscued a fairly standard clearance. You know, it's basic analysis, but the players aren't playing at the level that they have before. And part of that is because there's something not quite, as Tom's saying, it's not working quite as well in terms of pressing from the front, because that creates anxiety at the back. So, I mean, you know, the things could be connected. They usually are, these things. But they can't concede as many goals as they are and expect to be anywhere near a title race this season. So that's their number one priority. Whether it's changing the high line, because there's even been, you know, murmurings from Van Dijk about that. People might have figured out how to play against the high line. Whether it's that, I can't see them sticking to it. And there are too many players that are playing below par. So, you know, how to fix Liverpool? It's stop conceding so many goals and conceding them first as well.
Yeah, even in the build-up for a couple of those Brighton goals, really half-hearted forward pressing from the likes of Mo Salah, who, you know, it was just, I'll sprint a couple of yards, I'll make it look like I'm trying to press, but actually I'm not putting my body in a position where I can contain the defender or dictate the direction in which they pass the ball. They go past him easy, they build an attack, and they end up with a goal. It's not the same Liverpool. It isn't. It just isn't. But when you look at their squad, I do think it's slightly disjointed. You've got sort of players. It's weird, right? If we take an Arsenal, for example, you know, there are a lot of players in that squad coming in, particularly in terms of transfers, who were in the same part of their careers. You know, there was a period where it was like, look, we're buying young players who you might not know much about, but we believe they could be good players. You look at the likes of Zinchenko and Jesus coming to the club, even a Ben White, and then you're thinking, right, okay, younger players that have played the Premier League that have proven they can cope with this level. Then you look at Liverpool and you sort of think, you bring in a striker from abroad who has a big reputation. Does he necessarily fit with your style of football? Maybe not, because Roberto Firmino seems to click and they're a totally different style of player. Then you've got the young players coming in. We know Harvey Elliott came in a while ago, but he got embedded into the team at the start of last season. He's come back, played a lot of minutes this year. Then you've added a Fabio Carvalho. This is a really young player who still needs to learn how to be a Premier League footballer first off. And you're looking around and you're thinking, right, you know, they've brought in the backup fullbacks, for example. Where's their recruitment going? Luis Diaz, again, similar to Nunes. Is it just about figuring out the players that they've got in the squad, the roles that they can perform best, and then, of course, what their level truly is? You know, are they good enough?
Well, to come back to your first point, Hugh, about the kind of what it's going to be like for the next season, that's the challenge for Klopp this season. And I think you go back to them winning the title, you go back to them all the success they've had under Klopp, you always knew what his best team was. You knew what his starting 11 was. You always knew that. And I, as you say, you don't feel that now. You've got a kind of mishmash of players of different levels in terms of experience and quality. But that's the challenge for him this season. If we can get to the end of the season and, you know, they're competing in the top four and maybe probably, you know, knowing Liverpool, probably still competing for a trophy, maybe even in Europe, and they know their best 11, they've got their players firing, like Gregor says, then they can come again and, you know, they'll be fine. But if, and who knows whether the World Cup will be a help or a hindrance with this, that's another factor when, you know, we've got another month of action. What will happen then? Then you've got a break. Then you've got players coming back. It fits this kind of slightly messy stop-start feel that Liverpool have got this season, where they go behind in games and then they're frantically trying to come back and pick up points. That's the challenge. Find out what your best 11 is and get the players firing.
Squads go through transition periods as well, and they're not always as you expect them. So we've always known that there was going to be a transition with a front three, and they probably didn't expect that Sadio Mane would be the one to choose when he left rather than the other way around. Jordan Henderson doesn't look as dynamic at the moment, and he's always a driving force in midfield. Thiago's, when he's you know, got to get him on the pitch more. And the line that jumped out of Paul Hurst's piece in the game today was that any of Manchester City's five centre-halves would probably be good enough to partner Van Dijk. So I think they need a centre-half. Like Matip, Gomez, Kounate's coming back, but he's injured. You know, he had a good... I still think they need another centre-half to compete on all these fronts. And they need a central midfielder. So you're talking about, where's the recruitment going? They've usually been one of the teams that were praised about preparing for these things. But this is a shock. No, they didn't expect this. So it might mean that they need to accelerate some of those moves. Surely we've got to praise Brighton now, yeah?
I was just about to.
Good.
You can host if you
want. No, I mean, I'm just getting worried there. I thought you were moving on, but...
Roberto De Zerbi had a great start as Brighton boss. It's a tough month for him because he'll face Manchester City, Chelsea and Spurs, as well as that trip to Anfield as well. He says he wants to keep it the basis of what Graham Potter did, wants to sprinkle in, some of what he brings in an attacking sense to their team as well. And he's been praised for his attacking teams in the past, and you wonder whether Brighton can keep up a top four chase. You know, they did have a 2-goal lead here, and all I'm saying is top four clubs.
It's a punchy few minutes for Wollstonecraft, isn't it? He's binned off Klopp, he's binned off Liverpool, and he's now got Brighton in the top four
clubs. You've got to hold on to the 3 points, shouldn't you? You know,
I mean, look, it was. Let's just say one thing. You know, we've talked about Wolves, we've talked about need for new managers. It's a great start for a new manager coming into this league. Yeah. They looked really intense. You know, we talked about Liverpool's pressing, heavy metal football, etc. There was only one team playing heavy metal football, and that was Brighton. Swarming forward when they had the chance, getting bodies in and around the box. I thought Danny Welbeck was great.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, everyone's favourite footballer. Everyone loves seeing Danny Welbeck play well. And I mean, we're going to talk about Trossard, but he was absolutely superb. And I think he's speaking in the game as well this morning, talking about De Zerbi and the manager, and saying about having text exchanges with him about, you're going to be great, you can do this, and getting involved in training and things like that's impressive in a short space of time. And after, you know, Potter was one of the longest serving managers, was so kind of intertwined with what Brighton were, like that's a quite a punchy job to take on, following in his footsteps, because, you know, like Welbeck, he was everyone's favourite manager, so he deserves credit for starting in this manner, that's for sure.
Liverpool averaged like 66% of the ball and they had 54 at home against Brighton. And that stat, I'm absolutely shocked that Tom hasn't come out with, because it's in Bill's column today. Trossard's the first visiting player to score twice in the opening 20 minutes of a league match at Anfield since Bert Lineker did so for Lincoln City in 1960.
There you go.
That's a feat in itself. You know, not many teams go to up against Liverpool, Anfield. So, yeah, all the praise in the world. He'd be mad to come in and say we're going to, you know, rip up and start again. So he's, you know, he's saying the right things there. But when you look at the formation, the system, having the kind of the two in behind Welbeck, but narrow, you know, not every manager would want to play that way. So it'd be interesting to see whether that continues. But that's the way that this team's been playing for a while and it suits them.
One of the biggest compliments I can give him is that the players look totally relaxed. The Brighton players didn't feel like it was their first day with a new coach. So whatever he did, he managed to put his players at ease for a trip to Anfield, which in itself, you know, you'd be worried as an opposition player anyway. You know, there are the worst case scenario can't be good away at Anfield, especially with the players that they've got, but they were totally calm. They looked like the team with all that big match experience over the last few years and not Liverpool. And I've got to say, Leandro Trossard is a player that I love. Good to hear the manager's been texting him, because it's about consistency for Trossard. Like, you know, during the international break, you watch Belgium play and they played well. I watched both of their games. Trossard is, you know, you see him at the end of the game. One of the games he's an unused sub and you think, blimey, they must have a great team if Trossard doesn't even get on the pitch. But actually, I do feel it is about consistency for him. When he plays great, when he plays well, he is great. When he doesn't play well, does he have that impact? I don't know. Is he underrated? Is he undervalued? Maybe I'm being harsh for the third or fourth time on this episode of the game. I don't know. What do you think, Tom? Is he an underrated player? We might as well talk about our most underrated players in the league.
I think he is underrated, but you're right Hugh about consistency, and I had to eat my own words on Saturday afternoon because we were looking ahead to Monday at Selhurst Park with Graham Potter, and I was saying to him, isn't Aubameyang the kind of striker you always needed at Brighton? And then looked at the scoreline at Liverpool and see Trossard getting a hat trick. So he was there all along. He just didn't perform in the right way. But yeah, I think Brighton are just a team full of underrated players, really, aren't they? And I think that's the legacy of what Potter had there, is that there were no superstars. He got them all to buy into what he wanted, into what he was trying to do. And they were a machine that worked, which is why it's so interesting to see whether it works at a big club, because it's, you know, it's, there are more egos, and it's being able to massage those and get them to buy into what you're trying to do.
Okay, let's ask about our most underrated players in the Premier League, shall we, Gregor?
Go for it.
Go on then.
All right, okay. I'm going. I was at Bournemouth versus Brentford at the weekend, which was a classic. But Ben Mee, still. Like some of his kind of interceptions or last ditch tackles or blocks, or there was a ball floated to the back stick with Kiefer Moore, the giant Kiefer Moore, lurking at the back post, and Ben Mee just, like, he's so brave as well, threw his head backwards at it, you know, away, knowing he could get absolutely clattered, like it was a goal saving clearance. I still think, although he's been spoken about for a long, long time now at Burnley, he's still underrated, and on a free, like. It was an absolutely inspired signing. It would have been for any Premier League team, like outside the top four or five clubs.
Classic hipster nomination, honestly. Finally joined the Ben Mee hype train. Now he's left Burnley and gone to Brentford. I get it.
And I'll go for a second one too at Brentford, because I've always loved watching Matthias Jensen. I did when they were in the Championship. He's such a classy footballer in midfield. And Brentford are doing, I've banged on about this a bit on the podcast this year, that kind of rotation with Rico Henry, was the left fullback, was going really high up the pitch in the first half, almost in the left wing, higher into the forward line when Brentford had the ball at the back. And Jensen was kind of rotating out to the left back spot to get on the ball. And he's always so calm in possession. He can, like, you know, he's playing in left back and he's getting the ball and skipping past players, switching play. Really, really, always looks like he's got time and space. Matthias Jensen, another player I really love to watch. So there's two from Brentford.
Okay.
I mean, I was going to mention Tarkowski and Mee just because it's a segment about underrated players, so it's fine. No, but you forced me to make a change. I mean, I think as well, we're not mentioning the game, but Newcastle's win at Fulham was very impressive. And I mean, is anyone else not having Miguel Almiron's goal, that volley? Absolutely superb. I'm not nominating him as my underrated player.
You're getting close to it.
That is an underrated goal for me if we're not talking about that.
Okay.
Dropping over the shoulder, left footed into the opposite corner. You're all sat there looking at me like it's a cross or something, a miss hit volley. Gregor?
Tom knows I think there's an element of luck to this one because we said it up here. I think he's kind of setting me up for this because I'll probably get abuse for it. I just think if you, Almiron couldn't do that very often.
Could any player though? Could
I
any
can't
player.
Wait. Clip,
no,
clip,
I think,
clip that
look,
up
it was
for
complete instinct.
Stomach.
Complete instinct. But I think it was also a little bit lucky.
Fine. Well, I won't nominate him as my underrated player, but I'll nominate someone else that I know from the pre-show chat that you're going to laugh at as well. Jordan Ayew for Crystal Palace.
Yeah.
I just think maybe underrated is the wrong word, but underappreciated perhaps might be okay. The right one. Because I just think Palace's forward line and some of the attacking players that they brought in, Edouard, Mateta, Zaha, Eze, Olise, he still gets picked, man. He always gets picked. And like, that assist.
That's how you back him up.
Let me finish.
Hit.
I'm about to tell you he's as good as Kevin De Bruyne, so just hold on a second. That assist for Edouard's goal, if you put those next to each other, we saw that clip doing the rounds on Spurs social media when Son basically scored the same goal twice against Leicester. Ayew into the box, whipped across the face of the defence for Edouard at the back post. De Bruyne to Haaland, same goal, no hype. Poor old Jordan Ayew.
Punchy show this, isn't it?
Yeah. I've gone for Harrison Reed at Fulham in central midfield.
Cool.
Who just does his job. I know that sounds really, really, you know, simple, but he's a great organizer. He puts his teammates in the right position. he works himself into the ground. I actually think, you know, in terms of a player who helped them get back up and what he did last time in the Premier League, I think he's more than good enough to be in the top flight, a top flight player consistently. Good start to the season once again with Fulham. I do think he's an underrated player because you never hear him really spoken about. The other one that might surprise you is the Leeds goalkeeper, Ilan Melier.
Big time. I'm with you. We're in agreement.
Big time.
who has made so many ricks in his short time in English football that you might be like, what? He's awful. But the saves that he's able to make, the one-on-ones in particular, and we saw that against Villa, I think he's as good as anyone else in that area of his game. He's 22 years old.
Yeah.
And doesn't look it.
I think that is the big thing for me as well. He's a goalkeeper in the top flight, in probably the most difficult league in the world. He was left massively exposed by Marcelo Bielsa's tactics, let's be honest. So
he's great with his feet as well.
Yeah. I think he could have big, like, Aaron Ramsdale energy where he could get a move to another club and all of a sudden everyone would start going, this guy's sick, what's going on?
Yeah.
Like, actually, you need a team to help you defend.
That's all right, though.
So I've gone for Ilan Melier. Okay, no hype on that one. I think he's a very good goalkeeper. He's maturing. He'll get better. Just needs to stack the weights up in the gym. All right, he's 6'4", so he's never going to be huge, never going to look like The Rock. But, you know, I do think he's got a bright future ahead of him, and Leeds United, the right place for him right now. So that is the end of the game.
I thought you did yours.
Wow. Oh, do you know what? I realised I asked you about Trossard on this question as opposed to just asking you about your underrated player. You get
better
the last
be good
word.
Now, Tom.
And now I was going to say, and now I'm going to say that
I always
I'm not
forget
even
things.
Sure it's an underrated player, but it's just an appreciation, which is actually Alex Iwobi because of the narrative
excellent
around
choice
him. Thank you. That's very kind. Because I just think momentum in football is massive, and this is a guy who was playing as a winger at Arsenal, was seen as the next big thing coming through, and the amount of hype, we were just using that word, hype, the amount of hype around him. And then you can kind of understand the move to Everton in 2019, but it was a little bit of a joke at the time. People mocked it, you know, £34 million for Alex Iwobi.
I agree.
I think it was overpriced. But that, the, you know, we've spoken about Harry Maguire and other players who price tags really affect players, don't they? The expectation and the reaction to those prices as well. But he's reinvented himself at Everton. And I remember seeing Lampard play him in midfield and thinking, hang on, is Alex, I think it was at West Ham, is Alex Iwobi playing in central midfield? And it seemed so wrong at the time, but it's worked. He's bought into it, and he's been part of this revival at Everton under Frank Lampard.
There you have it. Our underrated players, you can share them with us. Hit us up on social media at TimeSport. Make sure you're subscribed to the podcast as well, thetimes.co.uk/thegame. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with me. Thank you all for listening. We will see you again on Thursday. Take care.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt, so throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.